how do they say, if you enjoy what you do, it's you never work a day in your life? So thanks everybody for being here. In my last section, I laid out how humans have impacted the Delta. This session is going to talk about how we could leverage nature to protect communities and enhance ecosystems too along the Delta. I want to ask y'all to jump in and ask questions often and early. And if I say something you don't understand, by all means, please jump in and get me to clarify. I live, eat, breathe this, so I'm eyeballs deep in it. So if there's something that maybe escapes you, please jump. I'd be happy to explain. So looking into the future, we need to look towards the past. And First Nations folks built mounds along the riverbank, one basket of mud and shell at a time. They knew they couldn't fight nature, so they built mounds like the one pictured to get up above any sort of negative effects of flooding. Together, they were able to live in places that were exceedingly productive. So the First Nations people had had a civilization before European settlers came to the area. Arrowheads made of stone from as far away as Yellowstone had been found in at some of these sites. And for the most part, they were able to live in harmony with water. And I want you to notice how a lot of the mounds are concentrated along the Mississippi River here in its floodplain and along the coastal zone. And this kind of line of mounds going up, that's the Red River. So where people didn't need to build mounds to escape that flooding, they just didn't. So this tuft of trees is known locally as the Lemon Trees, and it's another mound built by First Nations people. And this site is near my home. It was a seasonal camp. The First Nations people, they understood when you're trying to enjoy the bounties of nature, but at the same time, you need to kind of escape its ravaging effects. About 300 to 500 years of occupation has been documented at this site, and modern man has managed nature in such a way where that site is actually in the process of eroding away. The tallest tree is now fell into the water. The area has converted from a completely freshwater marsh with distributaries of the Mississippi River into a brackish bay. The mound has raggio clam shells, which are a freshwater clam in Louisiana, and folks are catching oysters there, which prefer much more saline waters. So for anyone who missed the first presentation, here are a few causes of the land loss in Louisiana. So there's subsidence, or the natural sinking of the Delta. What's going on is, it's the newest land in America, so it's compacting, it's oxidizing, and there's also oil and gas-induced subsidence, where fluids like oil and water are extracted from the ground, and that further increases that rate of subsidence. And so sea level rise, we've only experienced about 7 inches of sea level rise over the last 100 years. That's not, hasn't been a very big factor in Louisiana just yet, but it will be in the coming years. The state of Louisiana is planning for between 2 and 4 feet of sea level rise over the next 50 years. So there's energy and navigation canals. There are about 20,000 miles of canals in Louisiana that were cut either for oil and gas exploration, for transportation, for pipeline canals, for navigation, for shipping and barge traffic. There's coastal erosion, so just natural bank line erosion, and of course hurricanes and saltwater intrusion. So saltwater rushes up these pipeline and navigation canals, and it converts freshwater, it kills the freshwater plants and converts that area of that robust wetland buffer into open water. Creates more risk for our communities and infrastructure. And so the river levees themselves have caused quite a significant problem. We'll go into how we could remedy that in a little while. So while the causes of land loss are many, there's quite a few tools in the toolbox to turn this around and use nature to protect our communities. So there's Barrier Island restoration, sediment diversions, and hydrologic restoration, which we're going to go into in just a second. And there's a lot of great opportunities to put these to work in Louisiana, and there's quite a few of these projects that have already been built. And so using I'm going to go over the multiple lines of defense strategy here. So starting at the Gulf of Mexico, when a hurricane is coming inland, the first line of defense is Bear Island chains. And so what these do, they serve as almost a speed bump for hurricanes, and they knock down storm surge. Moving further inland, any sort of marsh or ridge is going to knock down storm surge as well. Every mile or so of wetlands knocks down storm surge about a foot. So it's quite critical to have a robust wetland buffer between, you know, the infrastructure and the Gulf. There are other things that could be leveraged to add to the multiple lines of defense strategy. Raised highways, floodgates, levees, pumping stations, elevated buildings, and then finally just all of those are kind of a risk reduction system. You just have to get out when a hurricane is coming through. So we'll talk about Barrier Island restoration for a little while. So they serve as a speed bump, and you can see this is a Barrier Island in the process of being restored. This Barrier Island is known as Grand Terre. It was an island. It was a part of a chain of islands that were about 40 miles long. It was a solid headland in the 1950s and 60s. What's going on here is sediment is being mined from the Gulf of Mexico, and it's being placed inside of these berms to enhance the island. And this project was started with money from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill finds. So marsh creation. Here's how we could mechanically build land. And so these are some of the pipes that are used for dredging. And so this project here is called the Lake Hermitage Marsh Creation Project. And it's a good example of how sediment could be mined out of the Mississippi River to build land in Louisiana. This project created about 1,000 acres of land, square acres of land. And what was going on here, you could see there's, you know, the area is kind of cut up by pipeline canals. These dead-end canals they're oil wells. This is oil and gas extraction. Notice there's none in this area. The marsh is largely intact, and that oil and gas activity induced subsidence in that area. When an area is just within 5 or 6 inches of sea level, it doesn't take much for it to go underwater. And so what was done here, cells were built, and sediment was pumped in from the Mississippi River to recreate land. So this is the project when it was completed. They actually built more land than they expected to do. The contractor did a really good job and came in under budget. So they were able to build some more seashore going up towards the top there. That was actually outside of the scope of the project. And so this is what it looks like from the air. It was so big, they actually had to create a new bayou through it called Willow Bayou. That's the squiggly line through the middle there. And so this is not a typical marsh, though. It's a very uniform sediment from the bottom of the Mississippi River. It's like a sandbar, and not like a true wetland would be in Louisiana. And so this project was built with a cutterhead dredge. And so the dredge mines sediment from the bottom of the river using this rotating cutterhead. And what's going on is they use diesel electric engines to power that. They've been pumping sediment for quite some distance in Louisiana lately. Up to about 22 miles, it's about 110,000 feet. So they've been doing some quite impressive work. This is another example of a marsh creation project. There's around 600 acres we're creating this site. It's called Bayou Grand Liard. You can see what was going on here. The Mississippi River would have been in this direction. This was a natural distributary of the river when the levees were created. After the Great Flood of 1927, it was easier just to cut that to cut those distributaries off, just build a levee instead of trying to build levees circling those distributaries that would fan out into the delta and bring that nourishing sediment and fresh water every year. And so there was an attempt here to recreate some marshes like you would have seen on the other side. And this project, the material was dredged from the Gulf of Mexico, and so it looks very much like this today, where nothing is really growing. The material from the Mississippi River bottom, things start growing before the project is even finished, like willow trees. It's quite good soil. It's coming from it's coming from the Mississippi River Valley. It's full of fertilizer, and this stuff right here, coming from the Gulf of Mexico, has a lot of salt in it, and so it takes several years before the rain is able to flush that out and get some new wetland plants to start growing here. And so, you know, marsh creation projects are great because you could build land almost instantaneously. It just takes a few months to build a 600-800 acre project. The permitting takes much longer. But the thing about a marsh creation project is they start sinking almost immediately. Before the equipment even goes away, those projects are settling. And the Grand Liard project, the interior of these cells are actually becoming open water now because they've sank so much. So by diverting river water out of the Mississippi River towards those marsh creation projects, you're able to keep up with that rate of subsidence because there's that sediment-laden water that's going in between those wetland plants. And to an extent, they can keep up with sea level rise. So I'll talk a little bit about how a sediment diversion works. So you can see in the top left-hand corner, this is, you know, kind of a average channel of the Mississippi River towards the delta. And to divert that sediment-laden water, it just takes a gap in the riverbank. Of course, you know, we're going to have some built that are going to be highly engineered, that are going to have gates that are going to open when the amount of sediment is highest in the river. So if you think about a river, when the river is on the rise, the driftwood all comes off the banks. And the same is true for the sediment. You know, when there's a lot more water added to that system, sediment is coming from uphill, and they could take advantage of just opening those diversions at a certain period of time. Over a period of years, subdeltas will begin to form, and it'll end up looking like the picture at the bottom here. And so this is an example of a privately built diversion. And what this gentleman did is, so this is the Mississippi River here, and he dug this cut right here in 2004. And so I was flying over this site in 2013 in the wintertime, and I was just astonished that this huge delta was starting to pop up, and it really doesn't look like much in this photograph. But you could see just the next year how quickly that delta was able to increase in size. And then in 2016, the entire pond is almost filled in. And so, like I said, a private individual did this project with his own money to mitigate some wetland impacts that were off-site. But this is a good example of how private individuals can kind of step up and help with the situation. Louisiana is kind of unique. 80% of the coastal zone there is owned by private interest. It's that's not typical around the U.S. Most areas below the mean high tide mark is public property.
Richie,
yes.
Does that mean that do they have to get state permissions?
Yeah.
Did he have to go through any bureaucracy or paperwork to do this?
Yeah. So what she's asking is, did he have to go through any bureaucracy or any paperwork to get a project like this created? And so, yeah, absolutely, he did. Instead of, you know, paying an outside mitigation bank for impacting wetlands, he had to petition the Corps of Engineers to build this project. They knew it was going to build a whole lot of land, so they allowed it to happen. It probably built land at a rate of, I would say, 60 to 1, what he impacted. So it was kind of a no-brainer decision to do, but he actually told me if it comes down to it, he wouldn't do it again because the paperwork was so difficult. He's an attorney. He says if he were billing his time, he would have spent over $100,000 of his own time to get the project done, whereas the equipment to dig the project was only $40,000 to do the actual work itself. So anyway, moving on. So even though it wasn't intended, this is a photograph of the Atchafalaya Basin and the Wax Lake Delta. The Wax Lake outlet was built to alleviate pressure in Morgan City. This is Morgan City here. It's an oil and gas port, and this is the Wax Lake outlet. And so what was happening, the flood walls were being threatened by high water in Morgan City. The Corps of Engineers dug the Wax Lake outlet as a relief channel, and there's so much sediment that's coming through the Atchafalaya River that in just a couple decades' time, it created these two deltas down here, the Atchafalaya Delta and the Wax Lake Delta, while also filling in the Atchafalaya Basin here. So you can see if we put that into play in the correct way, we could build a whole lot of land and protect the city of New Orleans. And so that was a really open water environment. You can see there's these huge deltas that are being formed out here in the Gulf of Mexico, but in interior marshes, you could build land strategically if if you use things to slow the river water down, like terraces. In terraces, what they do is they create turbulence in the water. So fresh water is entering the area kind of from the left, and they hit these, they're basically speed bumps. And what's going on here, it's one of the black dots that's out of line up there. That's a marsh buggy excavator. Think about like a track hoe excavator, but on floating tracks. Give you the idea of the size of this project. It's about a 1,500-acre project. And what they did is they borrowed material from the site, and this is these lighter areas here, and they built these earthen terraces. The material is about the consistency of tapioca pudding. It's really, really sloppy stuff. And so what they do is they have to pile up a little bit, let it dry out a little bit, and then put another lift on it. And this project was relatively inexpensive. It was only about a $1.6 million project. This is when the project was under construction in the spring of 06, and this is the same project in October of 2014. And you can see what it's doing. It's actually making land outside of the project footprint. So there's a new pass forming here of the Mississippi River. So if you were at the presentation yesterday, I was talking about how we had to take 31 place names off of the nautical charts that NOAA said, you know, this is just open water now. We don't need these place names anymore. So in this area, which is just across the river from that area, we're actually going to have to start naming new bayous. And so, you know, in just 8 years' time, you can see the difference here and what it makes. And the thing is, this project has had zero maintenance since its construction. It could definitely benefit from a few of these channels being blocked or some newer channels being opened up, or an additional terrace field being built up here where this huge flat is forming. And so this is a pretty small-scale project, but they could really be done on a huge scale. And so here's a little bit more close-up view. And you can see, these pictures are from 2014, but now a lot of these terraces, the land is beginning to touch one another. So instead of just a small marsh here, it goes all the way across. So there's some really, really promising results by just, you know, being strategic about how we slow down river water. And so this is an aerial photograph of that project site. You can see how this bay here is about 2 or 3 feet deep just about everywhere you go. And what the responsible party did is they created a crevasse right here. So they created a new distributary to allow sediment-laden fresh water into that bay. And so we'll go back here. You can see the crevasse isn't there. And then you can see how the terraces are beginning to fill in. And so this is just another form of terracing. It's a kind of the same style. It's just a little bit smaller project, but it's having a lot of success. This is just further downriver. And so when you mix sediment pumping, so mechanically dredging sediments from the bottom of the Mississippi River and terracing, you can build a whole lot of land relatively quickly. And so this project's called West Bay. And what was going on down by West Bay, a huge crevasse was dug with a big dredge up here. And what was going on, that crevasse was so large and there was so much velocity going through there that none of the sediments could really fall out to the bottom and stick to create land. And so a local cattle rancher suggested to the Corps of Engineers that they build some islands out there to help slow down that water, and they did. These are the islands here. And so this is kind of the evolution of the project here. And so in 2003, the cut was dug. And about in 80 years' time, this area has changed so much. It was land, it was water, it was land, it was water. Because it's sinking so quickly, there were some other distributaries that opened up. They're trying to reclaim it. So they opened up that crevasse there. And then for a long time, nothing was really happening. Actually, the bay was getting deeper. And a lot of people wanted to close that crevasse. It was causing shoaling of an anchorage that ships would use here called the Pilot Town Anchorage. And so these were an example of some of the islands that were built. And so the anchorage had to be dredged anyway. So they just, they drug the pipe over the riverbank, and they built these islands out in the middle. And, leave it to the Corps of Engineers to come up with an acronym for a sandbar. They call these things SREDs, or Sediment Retention Enhancement Devices. And so over time, the turbulence created by those threads has built up quite a bit of land. Here is, these are quite old. These are probably from 2009 or so. But there's a whole lot of land out there. You have to be really strategic when you go in a boat. It's quite hard too. It's these sandbars, you could drive a cement truck across them. They're so hard. And so these are an example of some of those big spreads. There's artificial islands that were built out there. But this is mostly new land created by the diversion itself. And so this slide takes us back full circle to living in water instead of fighting it. Residents, residents know that wetlands can knock down storm surge, but they're also realists too, and they have to, we're having to start living in elevated homes and finding unique ways to do business in South Louisiana. So homes like this are pretty common in the area. So I kind of ran through this one, but tomorrow's session we're going to explore how to create a plan to live better with water in the face of rising seas in Louisiana. And so in my work, we've been trying to look at how to do that in an equitable and democratic way as possible.
On lots of those buildings out there, is most of the way transportation by boat?
Yeah. So he's asking if is most of the transportation by boat to some of the elevated homes? There's a lot of elevated homes that are on roadways. I would say there's more elevated homes that have access to a road than that don't. There's a lot of, like we say, fishing camps or hunting cabins that are elevated. But I'm thinking of some neighbors in particular. They have a ranch house. It's a slab house like you would see in any suburban neighborhood. And it's jacked up on 22 or 25 foot concrete piers now. And so there's a kind of a cottage industry of home shoring in Louisiana that's really taken off. There's really no limit to how high you could raise a home, but once they get so high, the wind starts to affect them. So, in regards to wind and water, it might be getting out of the frying pan and into the fire. But generally, it seems like the water does more damage to people's houses. But it's not limited to private, single family homes. This is a good example of, the faculty housing for the teachers down in Plaquemines Parish. And what they've done is, living in an elevated house has challenges. I mean, my back is probably a little bent out of shape trying to get my dad's refrigerator up his stairs. It's like, this house is 16 feet in the air. We were remodeling it, like pushing his, French doors up the stairs and I'm still feeling it. But anyway, so this example includes elevated walkways. So the houses are connected, so you don't have to run down 35 stairs, run up 35 stairs, ask your neighbor to borrow a cup of milk or something, and then do the whole process in reverse. These houses kind of turn into sky islands if you don't get around so well. And what they've done here is, they have stairs, but they share a good commercial elevator. So a lot of the single houses that are just kind of raised up on their own, people have built these kind of impromptu elevators or grocery lifts using like a electric hoist, and they're probably not the safest. So this is a good example of how you can still have a sense of community while being safe from water.
Are a lot of these being funded by FEMA, or are the residents paying for them themselves to do the raising? Yeah.
So that structure in particular was paid for by FEMA because it replaced another faculty housing that was raised off the ground. I think they only raised it 3 or 4 feet. I would love to see them say, hey, let's go 10 feet higher. We know we're going to have more and more intense storms.
So how hurricane-proof are these structures?
I would say these are pretty hurricane-proof. They've been built in a way where they could just be pressure washed out after a hurricane. I'm sure they would need to be repainted, new electrical.
But do they pay federal flood insurance out there?
I'm not sure if the school board does or not. A lot of people are self-insured. They live in an exceedingly risky area. They're commercial fishermen engaged in a cash economy, and so they're just kind of paying as they go and crossing their fingers. But yeah, a lot of people do not have flood insurance. Good.
We were down there a few years ago for Katrina, right? They had houses like this. But they had where the poles are, they use that like a garage or something like that. But they're built with the idea that if a hurricane comes through, they blast that out. It doesn't hold the water because of damage. Is that still being done or not?
Yeah. So are you asking about the breakaway walls and how people use the underside of their home as an above-ground basement?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely a thing. So below my dad's house, you know, he has his houses on stilts that are, yeah, it's very similar to the poles in here, about 16, 20 feet high. And underneath, he has kind of a garage and shop space. He sells live bait, so he's like an ice machine and bait tanks and things like that under his home. But yeah, a lot of folks, I watched them lose their houses on stilts because they decided to build like a game room or extra bedrooms under their house, as it was 30 years since the last flood. And by having those extra walls, it there was a lot of extra pressure. When Katrina came through, we had about a 16-foot levee in town, and it was a waterfall in every direction. The levee didn't fail, it was just overtopped in every direction, and quite suddenly. So if you can imagine, you know, one of these waterfalls you've seen around here, probably more water than that, overtopping the levee and hitting homes all of a sudden. And so that extra force just pulled them down. They were just turning to matchsticks. So it's strategic that there's nothing under there but just some vehicles.
Where you were showing new land, do they overtly plant things or is it natural revegetation?
So there wasn't anything planted at this site here, these terraces. And there was some spartina, which is like it's kind of an oyster grass planted here. But the area is so fresh. There's species like bulrush, which is kind of a black, it looks like a tube almost, it's round. There's cattail, elephant ear, willow. They actually planted the wrong species there. When they did this project, they were building the terraces to break up what's called fetch. And fetch is the distance across water that waves have to build up. And but they kind of served the opposite purpose of, not the opposite, but an additional purpose of slowing down that water and causing a lot of accretion. But there are other places that people do plantings. And I have a buddy of mine who works for the state Ag and Forestry Department, and he does quite a few plantings where he's able to plant bulrush, so this darker green vegetation here. It can grow out of 2 or 3 feet of water, and he'll plant that in the line to kind of create new islands. And that will serve the same purpose as these terraces. But so he's trying to get the same effect without using any sort of heavy equipment. And to an extent, he's been kind of successful.
Is this an area where you can put cypress trees?
Yeah, so this area is intertidal. So while there's fresh water, when the tide comes up and down, it's affected by the tide. And there are certain times a year when the river is low, like September, October, when a south wind will drive salt water in there, so you might not want to plant cypress trees in this area. But there's willow trees that are holding on that are, you know, 6-7 years old now. So, I mean, there's a possibility that they could be there.
Is there a negative to doing these projects, or is it just the inhibiting factor, the bureaucracy, and the cost? I mean, is anybody opposed to doing this, or is it you just can't do enough of it fast enough?
I would say, okay, so he's asking that, is there anything negative about doing these types of projects? I would say no, there's not. Occasionally, folks that will be using these sunken wetlands that are now open water, maybe they're running crab traps or shrimping or oystering in the area, you know, of course, they don't, you know, they might not want new land to be put back in an area where maybe they've been fishing for a generation or two. I would say, you know, the oyster industry doesn't want the fresh water that these projects bring. That's a big thing. You know, my stepdad's an oyster fisherman. We've had many long discussions about this. But at the end of the day, if we want to save coastal Louisiana or get a couple extra generations out of it, like this is the type of work we have to do. And so.
So, if I can ask, when the Corps of Engineers looks at something, what do they evaluate? I mean, you said it was like $100,000 worth of permit. Obviously, they must be doing, I mean, do they want studies? Are they looking for, I mean, what do they evaluate in deciding whether or not to grant a permit?
So you're asking, you know, what exactly is the Corps looking at when they're for the permitting for these projects? I think they don't want any sort of types of negative impacts. They don't want any wetlands to be impacted. sometimes things are taken to the extreme where, you know, the state is trying to do a coastal restoration project that's going to have a net increase of wetlands, and they might impact a small area, and they'll still have to pay mitigation, you know, through the core system. So that takes time, that takes a lot of paperwork. It's just a gross violation of common sense in many cases. There's ways to do this without compromising bedrock environmental laws that I'm really hoping that the agencies in charge of this work can get better at, because there's a whole lot on the line, and time is of the essence to do this. There was a whole lot of land created here in just a pretty short amount of time. This can be done on a landscape scale. The way these projects are doled out, there's a contract given to do, you know, X amount of feet of terraces in this envelope. And maybe we need to reevaluate how we're doing that. Maybe instead of one specific project that this is, maybe that guy on the excavator, maybe that needs to be just like a 9-to-5 job. Like, he jumps in a speedboat, he fills it up with diesel in the morning, and he just eats all week long, goes home at the end of the day, and then the next week he just does it all over again. Of course, you know, like I said, that, you know, there's bedrock environmental laws, the permitting needs to kind of be out ahead of that, but I think we could really speed up the productivity for sure.
How is the ownership of this new land determined?
That is a serious issue in Louisiana, and there's a lot of sportsmen that are being gated out of waterways right now. They're actually in the process of forming a coalition to try and solve that watershed access issue. As I mentioned, you know, this is all private land here. There's a few slices of land in there that over the years have been donated to the school board or owned by the local government from somebody not paying taxes. But this land was all given to folks through this French and Spanish land grants, and then over the years bought and sold. So it's, you know, this piece of land, there's a lot of duck hunting that goes on. It's fresh water, there's emergent marsh. It's really prime duck hunting territory. So it's all posted. I don't know how I haven't gotten in trouble. I just go where I want. But I'm sure it's going to catch up to me. But it's becoming a serious issue. And in those sportsman groups, what they're starting to do is they're becoming pretty savvy. They're starting to call in, you know, talk radio when a politician is on there. They're going out. They're showing up to the Capitol with their boats behind their trucks. So they're trying to be noticed. But, you know, the 80% of coastal Louisiana that's owned by private landowners, the biggest landholders in the state are the oil and gas entities. So, you know, ConocoPhillips owns a whole lot of land through another company called Louisiana Land and Exploration. Apache is an energy company based in Houston, Texas. They own a whole lot of southwest Louisiana. And they have gates across bodies of moving water. So, you know, bayous that have tide that is moving through them, they have them gated off. It's things are kind of coming to a head, and I think there's going to be a conversation in Louisiana about the coast as a commons. You know, here it is. We need a robust wetland buffer to protect our communities and infrastructure. And you have the state that's doing work, and it's just kind of handed over to private individuals for them to, you know, use how they see fit, and that's raising the temperature of a lot of people. I mean, it's getting some people really upset. I hope we can come up with a solution pretty soon. I'm seeing gates that are starting to go up in my area. It's been more common further towards the west from where I live, but the other day I had, you know, some folks on my boat, and I came up to a huge gate. You know, I'm like, man, I'm glad I wasn't running through here at night, you know, through here at night, because I would have ran into it.
Yeah, just to follow up to that, I mean, who are they keeping out? I mean, everyone, obviously, but is it, yeah, why the gates?
So who are they keeping out when they put up gates? So anglers, hunters, commercial fishermen, whether they're catching crabs or shrimp, things like that. My activity out in the bayou, I'm doing eco tours, so that's maybe even tourists, you know, keeping tourists out. It's not good. I wish that would definitely change.
It's
possible it's someone's liability.
Yeah,
because
I'm sure.
Like there's a place in the Beaverton area where Nike owns a forest and they put a path through the forest for their employees, but they don't want anybody else in that, on that path because of the liability issues that they worry that something's going to fall on there and sue Nike.
I think, you know, also they're worried about maybe boat wakes, kind of tearing up some of the wetlands as well. But there's, you know, these areas, they're, you know, they're privately held, and so if anybody had access, then anybody could duck hunt there, and then the people leasing the land wouldn't have, you know, they wouldn't have that advantage that they have. You know, hunting is one thing, but, you know, they're keeping out other anglers, and, you know, you're fishing in intertidal waters, and, you know, Louisiana is the only state in the union that the laws don't jive with the other, you know, the others, so it's going to be interesting.
Napoleonic code.
Yeah. No doubt. It's definitely left over from the Napoleonic code.
What kind of taxes do these homeowners pay?
I'm sure it's the equivalent to what, you know, homeowners pay the rest of the country. So if you occupy your home in Louisiana, the first $75,000 are exempt with your, you know, homestead exemption. That's pretty common in other areas of the South. But these wetlands, they're only taxed at like 50 cents an acre a year or something. It's just hardly anything. It's, yeah. The value of the wetlands on paper is, it's only about $200 an acre or so, but they often go for much, much more. But, you know, that being said, the local government here, they own between 80 and 100,000 acres of wetlands. They're not trying to make any money off of them besides the oil and gas royalties. They're not, you know, they're not, the only recently they start collecting money from alligator eggs, alligator trapping. There's a lot of illegally built camps on public land that they're not, you know, they could be getting $100 a month, you know, fair market for that, where that camp is. They're not doing that. They could be leasing out areas to people duck hunting. So, I mean, I think the local governments can kind of think of creative ways to finance some of these restoration solutions. You know, I think there's some really good public-private partnerships, too, that could be leveraged.
Have you thought about getting a law degree?
No. I have not thought about getting a law degree.
What do you do with alligator eggs?
So, alligator eggs are taken to an alligator farm where they incubate the eggs, they hatch them, and then they raise the eggs. I mean, they raise the small alligators. There's, you know, alligator meat. There's the skins. They're required by law to put back 14% of the alligators, which is once they get to about 3 feet, it's actually higher than the survival rate. So. The American alligator in Louisiana was on the verge of extinction, and they started, putting up some basic harvesting rules, and that totally flipped around. So areas like this could benefit from more alligator reintroduction. So there's an invasive rodent in South Louisiana called the Nutria. I think there's some in Oregon, too. There's So the real name is Koipu, but the fur is called Nutria, and so the name kind of stuck. But what's going on here, in the wintertime, all this new grass gets ate up. And so the state of Louisiana has a nutria bounty. So the state of Louisiana puts up $5 for every tail that folks bring back. And to get into that program, there's a lot of hoops you have to go through. You have to have signed permission from the landowner. You have to have a map with the township and range and all this other stuff. So, but a natural solution reintroducing alligator in this area could really help, make land show up even quicker. If those wetland plants are there all year round, capturing that sediment, the land's going to show up a lot quicker.
I came in late, so maybe I missed this, but is there an estimated lifetime for these recreated wetlands, or are they expected to be permanent?
So there was two different types of ways to make a wetland, and one is dredging sediment out of the Mississippi River or out of the Gulf of Mexico, piling it up. And the other is by diverting that sediment-laden fresh water. By pumping, with pumping, that project is going to sink below the surface of the water in about 20 years' time. But if you pump the land in, with a dredge and then divert, then it has the potential to last much, much longer. In some cases, those wetland plants will even be able to keep up with the rate of sea level rise or relative sea level rise because the area is sinking. But some of the bigger projects, like the engineered diversions that are going to be on the river, those, you know, like something like this that's going to be built, but on a huge landscape scale, like for instance, the mid-Barataria sediment diversion, which is in the EIS process right now, it's going to have about a 50-year life, but it's probably going to last much, much longer. That's going to be a huge concrete structure. Most of the core projects last a really long time. Well, thank y'all for coming. I'm going to give y'all some time back. Yeah.